You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 5th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, infections rise across the globe. In the U.S., it's a race between vaccines and the fourth wave. Meanwhile, Major League Baseball to move the All-Star game from Atlanta over Georgia's new voting laws. This following more corporate pushback to those same laws. And pushback from Georgia lawmakers onto those corporations. New reason to believe Joe Biden committed to infrastructure via reconciliation. However, getting some pushback from Democrats too. On a raise to corporate taxes, a modest raise, as Janet Yellen will be calling for a global minimum corporate tax. Embrace Trumpism, says a key Republican House member in memo form. Meanwhile, in the wake of a COVID relief bill, Medicaid expansion is now being contemplated in several red states. Imagine that. Minnesota police chief expected to testify today in the Derek Chauvin trial. Joe Biden to repeal Trump's sanctions on the International Criminal Court. Facebook springs a leak. 533 million people's phone numbers and personal data dumped online. And lastly, a heartfelt apology from Amazon to Congressman Mark Pocan. And they concede that indeed their drivers need to pee in bottles. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am back from my vacation. And, of course, still holding down the fort. Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well. Happy Monday.
Yes, indeed. It is a happy Monday. I am actually going to get my second vaccine today, if all works out.
Toot, toot, toot.
Yes. I did a lot. The way I ended up getting mine, although I'm now well eligible in New York, but the way that I ended up getting mine was walk-ins, where sort of like a walk-in type of situation where you get on a waiting list at a pharmacy. But the difficulty with that is you don't get a specific second appointment.
Yeah.
And so I called. They said, can you come in later this afternoon? And I was like, yeah, of course.
I got mine at the Javits Center here in New York, and it was an unbelievable operation. I mean, just it's like in vastness and scale and scope and efficiency. It was something to behold.
And I imagine you may have mentioned this on Friday, although I cannot remember. There was a big production problem with a subcontractor of Johnson & Johnson's, and 15 million doses. And I believe they were also the same subcontractor was doing some AstraZeneca vaccines as well. AstraZeneca not approved in this country. We are sending some of those to Mexico and Canada at this point. We should probably be sending all of it, frankly. And frankly, we should be taking the patent protections off so that this production can exist throughout the world. There are many places where the productions can happen, but we are protecting the profits of some pharmaceutical companies, which, of course, all of these companies, incidentally, all of them, in some form or another, develop these vaccines with government support, either our government or other governments. But this was not one of those situations where somebody was just in their garage and developed this because they had, I don't know, leveraged their credit card or something. And nevertheless, apparently Johnson & Johnson has stepped in and has taken over the operations in that for that subcontractor, who apparently that subcontractor has received multiple FDA sanctions for their operations. I sort of feel like in that type of business, it should be one and done.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. When you mix ingredients to the point that you contaminate 15 million vaccine doses in the middle of a crisis, there should probably be some just repercussions and shuttling away.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so. Meanwhile, we will talk today about the pushback to the Georgia voting laws. And also, there's another dynamic here. There's multiple dynamics to this. One is that we're seeing corporations try and brandish their, their socially acceptable bona fides by pushing back on laws that diminish our democracy in many respects. I'll take the help where it comes from, but I think we should be careful not to provide too much credit to these companies, or I should say, let's not kid ourselves here. They're yes. still in the, you know, this is just it's a campaign. It's a promotional campaign. I am glad that corporations are doing this, but let's not kid ourselves as to what their intentions are. But what's also fascinating is that we're seeing some of this return to the mean, if you will, with a sector of our journalism that is desperately looking to reestablish the sense that they are so-called objective, as opposed to, you know, because it was difficult for some journalists to respond to Donald Trump in a way that did not make them feel like they weren't being overly reactive or too emotional or too carried away or too partisan. And so there's this desperate need to return to a both-sidism. And one of the places you see that first is with data journalists, so-called data journalists. And there's a piece in the New York Times we're going to talk about by Nate Cohn, who has written a piece essentially saying, more or less, people are overreacting on both sides about this Georgia voting laws.
Oh, both sides.
Exactly. And it's almost too perfect, but we will talk about the flaws in that piece. We also will be talking about the infrastructure bill and this memo coming out of the Republican House, basically saying embrace Trumpism. And it's a good explanation of what Trumpism is, which is sort of like a head fake to workers' rights, but really focus on, the culture war, which, of course, you know, you can call it Trumpism, but I'm still old enough to remember when Pat Buchanan called for this in 1993, where Dan Quayle, the vice president to the to George H.W. Bush, who was supposedly one of those sort of like old school moderate Republicans, Dan Quayle was attacking Murphy Brown. Do you know who Murphy Brown is? Not a person. Murphy Brown was a sitcom character.
Right.
And she, I want everybody to sit down for this. She had a child out of wedlock.
That's unacceptable.
Apparently, it was. So, I mean, there's not much new here, but we will get to the latest iteration of it. But first, we're going to talk about the infrastructure bill that Biden is going to be rolling out. Parts of this, there's a lot of pushback to it. Part of that is because it contains I guess it depends on what you want to refer to it as. It's an increase in the corporate taxes relative to the past 2 years. It's still a decrease to the corporate taxes as to where they were just 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. But we will get to that. But first, let's check and see how our barometer of the Republican Party is dealing with this. Because this came out quite a bit in the Sunday talk shows, both the taxation part of it, but also the determination of Biden to go through reconciliation when it becomes quite evident that there is no Republican support for the desperately needed infrastructure. And really, I mean, infrastructure in the broadest sense. But here is Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends taking issue with how broad the term infrastructure is being applied here. Because infrastructure could mean, you know, like, we'll talk about the infrastructure of the show, but we don't have any highways in the show.
Yes, it's a broad term. Here we go.
Let's play this.
$589 billion for workforce development, $400 billion for home and community-based care for elderly and disabled. Yeah, it's an important thing, but how is that infrastructure? $650 billion for broadband, I think that should be. But then they have green energy and water upgrades, and they have retrofitting homes and buildings. To what? Make the windows smaller, make them green-friendly.
That's Green New Deal.
This is the new Green Deal. That Joe Biden was the moderate that can get elected. Nobody with those severe left-wing views would have gotten elected. But if you pretend to be a moderate and you go ahead and implement those left-wing programs, there's nothing you can do.
Well, okay. So they are in favor of infrastructure for broadband and for everything that doesn't involve anything that addresses climate change is basically what they've narrowed it down
to. Well, if I'm not mistaken, Kilmeade had an issue with pipes, which I think is the most sort of obvious definition of infrastructure.
Well, they should be shocked because they're in favor of lead in the water and have consistently been so for poor communities.
Apparently. And frankly, around the country, we have not upgraded our pipes. This is a problem in many, many cities. We desperately need this. I don't know how you can say energy consumption and the means in which we could reduce our energy consumption and our carbon fuel consumption is not part of infrastructure. I also, frankly, don't know how you can say, and there's $400 billion in here to shore up Medicaid, and specifically home care services. We have the baby boom is now getting older and really are frankly old, and they need more and more support. And I can tell you this going through this myself, that there is not enough support for home care, for home aid in that respect, folks, elderly folks who become disabled in some fashion or another. And If infrastructure is not creating the mechanisms to keep people well and functioning in our society, I mean, what else could it be? And all of this, incidentally, Joe Biden, all of this was in his campaign, in his platform.
Right. Well, he was pretending to be a moderate, but then when he implements it, he's a radical leftist, obviously. As you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other members of Congress who are progressive saying that this is woefully insufficient, which $2.25 trillion to be implemented over 10 years should be treated with scorn from the left. That is not enough, and not the figure that even Joe Manchin was pushing for. He was saying, let's do $4 trillion, let's do this. Yeah, infrastructure can apparently mean whatever people want it to mean. Republicans want infrastructure to basically be tax cuts for the rich. That's essentially what their definition of it is. Loot the rest of the federal government even more so than they already had. But what strikes me is how weak even Kilmeade's argument is there. He is not. We are seeing the air, you know, the mattress be deflated, right? Or whatever.
The air mattress.
I'm thinking about an air mattress. Yeah.
Right.
I could use a balloon in that situation.
The tire being deflated, maybe?
Yeah, I'm just trying to expand my artistic repertoire. Yeah, tire's another one. I would lose Family Feud on things that would be
the
deflated.
The football being deflated?
Yeah, you've listed three things that are better than what I just used.
But your point is a good one, which is that they don't really have much. The idea that Kilmeade is complaining because we thought Joe Biden was a moderate. I'm quite sure that if we were to go back and look at the way that Brian Kilmeade described Joe Biden 6 months ago, he was not saying this is just some moderate who's going to come in, mm-hmm. as if like all the Fox viewers had voted for Joe Biden. I mean, what it is a sign that they are frustrated and have no grip on what the Republican right-wing message is yet. Now, they know what it's ultimately going to be, and we will talk about that when we come back from break, because there's a memo going around that I think really does is going to be something that we would look back upon 18 months from now and say, there it was, folks. You can check it out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. In the meantime, folks, I have some right here, actually.
Liquid IV?
Liquid IV.
See, maybe that's what I need, because I'm just having some Mondays right now. I'm going to put some liquid IV in my drink.
Well, as you know, when you push your body hard or you're just feeling run down,
mm-hmm.
important to take care of ourselves with proper vitamins and nutrients. Now, generally, folks, I'm drinking the energy multiplier with liquid IV during the show, but gotten a little bit of a hankering for the immunity, the immune support. Liquid IV created hydration multiplier plus immune support to maintain and strengthen your immune system. Hydration multiplier plus immune support is a cutting edge blend of vitamin C, zinc, and Wellmune in a convenient single serving packets to help strengthen your immune system. This blend is powered by cellular transport technology, which is designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other nutrients. Each packet is bursting with fresh, natural tangerine flavor. It's true. I got my whole water thing full of it right here. It really does taste. The tangerine is really good. Liquid IV can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. And with every purchase, Liquid IV donates a serving of Liquid IV to someone in need. Company has donated over 10 million servings globally. I've talked about my... Did you just use your highlighter to mix that?
I was hoping you wouldn't notice.
Oh, my God.
I don't have a spoon here.
All right. Now, generally...
God damn it.
I go for the matcha energy multiplier, but the last couple of days I've been going with the immune thing. Mm. And I don't know if it's because I love the tangerine flavor or I'm feeling like I need the immune support. Like I'm going into spring and I'm getting ready. Maybe I'm about to get out there. I'm getting my second shot. So whatever. I mean, I can tell you that we are huge fans of Liquid IV here. Back in the days where we used to do something called plane travel. Mm-hmm. And when I was traveling or you get dehydrated or when I would maybe go out and drink too much. Now, maybe when I stay in and drink too much next day or even that night, sometimes I'll finish it up with a Liquid IV. And of course, it helps me through the show. Get your Liquid IV hydration multiplier plus immune support in bulk at Costco or order online and get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep. It's MajorityRep at checkout. That's anything off, 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. And speaking about going out, get my second vaccine. That means I'm going to start getting back out there. And that means that, yes, I need to update my wardrobe a little bit. I got an easy way of doing it. For me, shopping for clothes, a little problematic. I have a little bit of style deficit, I think. Well,
you wear 5 shirts a week, so.
Well, I have very specific shows for shirts for the shows, and then also very specific ones for not. So, yes, I'm trying to break out of that. It's really hard for me. Stitch Fix has made it easier. Stitch Fix offers clothing hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, style, and budget. Every piece is chosen for your fit and your life, so you can look and feel your best. You try on pieces at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. Stitch Fix has free shipping and easy returns on exchanges. A prepaid return envelope is included. There's no subscription required. You'll pay just $20 for a styling fee for each box, and that gets credited toward pieces you keep. There are no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit any occasion for women, men, kids. They ship all over the U.S. They're available in the U.K. as well. For me, I have made the Nashville Five Pocket straight pant that I have has basically, I don't want to get overly dramatic about it, but yeah, I'm back into that style of five pocket pants.
No, you've mentioned it a few times.
I used to be just like one type of pant that was like a work pant that as long as it had a belt loop, I would wear it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm back into like the five pocket style because of my Nashville five pocket. And then, of course, I got my leather chukkas or chukas. I don't know how to say that, but they're penguin modern leather chukkas or chukas. And that's when I start going back out. Those things are waiting there for me. Oh, yeah.
Lady killers?
Maybe. I don't want to brag, but get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. As always, you will find links to those, both those places in our YouTube and podcast description. And just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support is very much needed. Okay, let's get back into just this. We saw over the weekend, there was a lot of talk about the infrastructure. And I can't help but think that the Republicans are starting to get the idea that the Democrats may actually go about this on their own. And you got Roy Blunt out on George Stephanopoulos this week, on ABC's This Week. And at one point he says, like, hey, this would be an easy do. We could do this with Republicans. If you just make the bill like a third of the size.
When it's already too small.
When it's already too small. And but here he is on debts and deficits. And this is him on Chris Wallace. I mean, they're sending him out a lot now this weekend. And I think a big part of it is that they are really getting the sense that, like, wait a second, none of the things we've done in the past are working. Democrats don't seem to be afraid of going alone on this. This is clip number one.
They think he's the best they got, I guess.
Say it today, but some of your colleagues in the Republican Party are complaining about this is going to explode debt, this is going to explode deficits. And I want to put up what the Republican record is on those. During the Trump presidency, even before the pandemic, the national debt increased by more than $3 trillion. And in 2017, every Republican in the Senate, including you, voted for the big Trump tax cuts, which cut revenue by almost $1.5 trillion. So I guess the question is, when I hear, for instance, Mitch McConnell talking now about, well, debt and deficits, hasn't the Republican Party, haven't you lost your credibility on this issue?
Well, I don't think anybody has a very good record for the last decade on this. I think the deficit under the Obama years and the Trump years are very similar. The tax cuts, however, in real revenue produced more revenue. In static revenue, they wouldn't, because you couldn't anticipate the kind of growth we had. And remember, after the pandemic did occur, we did five. Not one, not two, not three, not four, but five bipartisan bills trying to be sure we stabilized this economy so we'd have a stable economy that would pay that debt off as we came out of COVID. Now we've seen one incredibly partisan bill from the new administration, followed by what it appears to be will be another incredibly partisan bill. You can't spread that blame around if you decide you're going to do it all by yourself.
Well, yes, I suppose that's true. I just want to make it clear. When I talked about the increase in debt during the Trump years, it was I did it purposely before the pandemic started. Senator Blunt, thank you.
I mean, first off, the best part of that whole thing is when Chris Wallace is laughing in his face and Roy Blunt can't help but laugh, too.
Yeah,
that was like apparently there's a QAnon documentary.
I've heard.
I don't want to do any spoiler alert on this, although someone clipped the, like the last moment. But
I started to watch it and thankfully stopped because I knew. Yeah.
But that moment reminds me of it where like they're off searching for maybe who might have been QAnon. But here is, I mean, look, and let me be clear about this. I am not concerned about the deficit growing. The deficit has been a mechanism in which has been deployed by so-called moderates, and you can really just refer to them as corporatists or just folks who are concerned, who are working on behalf of the ultra wealthy in this country. And when they deploy deficit scare, it is a precursor to cutting things generally like Social Security or Medicare.
Yep.
And Medicaid.
We saw that in the Obama years. I mean, and that was calls were coming from inside the House in that area where people were saying, I mean, that was we got dangerously close to that becoming a reality.
Barack Obama and Joe Biden basically offered to cut Social Security to the Republicans, and fortunately for us, the Republicans were just completely against saying yes to anything that the Obama administration said. And fortunately, after about 3 or 4 years, the Obama administration gave up on that idea. The Democratic caucus in the Senate voted to increase, as a resolution, increase Social Security and killed that at least deficit hawkery amongst Democrats. And what we're seeing now is in many respects a new era of less concern by Democrats. I say less concern because, like you mentioned earlier, this infrastructure bill was going to be bigger by Joe Biden's Joe Biden anticipated this being bigger. At one point, he said $3 trillion. At one point in some meeting, he said $5 trillion. You had Joe Manchin saying $4 trillion. And then folks like Larry Summers and some of these Obama people come back and say, whoa, the deficit, the debt, et cetera, et cetera. But as a political matter, the Republicans losing their credibility on this point is huge. I mean, you can put up this graph.
Let's put the right. This is I was looking this up after that clip, and Brendan found this, just the deficit, how it's trended throughout presidencies. And in the pandemic or under Trump, and in the pandemic, it ballooned. But I mean, Obama reduced the deficit after the economy crashed. I mean, he did. That is a fact. And yet Roy Blunt is trying to both sides it on Chris Wallace's program in order to make the case that, everyone's equally at fault, even though we ran on this issue in a whole election cycle with the Tea Party and have been using it as an excuse to implement our austerity politics for decades at this point. But it's both sides, since you've got me cornered on how much we balloon the debt and deficit,
even,
as if it mattered.
But even both sides.
Yeah.
Fine. Democrats increase debt. They don't. I mean, there's not enough evidence of that. And frankly, I would say to their discredit, they have not. Bill Clinton made a big deal about trying to put us on a track to get a surplus. And ultimately what happened is we had a recession that followed that, because when the government has a surplus, that means there's a deficit on the private side. Nevertheless, as a political matter, even if they have to say both sides, they have given up that this arrow no longer exists in their quiver. And the fact that he goes on Fox News and Chris Wallace laughs in his face and Blunt's only reaction is to smile, they have nothing to push back on this. So here's the point. When we analyze Biden's bills here, understand that the only limiting principle on these things is the will of the Democratic Party. There is no, there, like, the Republicans have yet to figure out how they're going to argue against these type of legislations. They can go out there and they can win elections because of things like gerrymandering, things like suppressing the vote, or maybe they're doing it because the American public is more interested in stuff like, we don't want COVID lockdowns, we don't want masks, we
or
don't want immigrants.
They can make it about the culture war,
exactly,
as they've done for,
exactly,
for, yeah.
But as but in terms of legislation, it is the Republicans are both irrelevant because of things like reconciliation, the opportunity to get rid of the filibuster, and irrelevant because their talking points have no resonance anymore. Not even Chris Wallace takes it seriously when the Republicans say there's a deficit issue here. And so this is really important to be aware of as we go forward. To the extent that you're going to see pushback, Republicans are going to say corporate taxes. You can't lower corporate tax, or you can't raise corporate taxes. When we raise them to 28%, we will still be 7% less than we were 4 years ago.
Bingo.
And on top of which, you're also going to hear the other thing that they like to deploy is this notion of capital flight. And in this instance, it is the fear that corporations will move to countries with a lower tax rate. And that's what's really interesting about what Janet Yellen is doing. Janet Yellen is going to imminently have her first major address as Treasury Secretary. And she is going to argue for the introduction of a global minimum corporate tax rate. Is reported by Axios. I think we also mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. There was some rumor that she was going to do something like this. Now, of course, we can't pass a law and restrict what other countries do. However, the Paris Climate Accords provide at least a model. This is where you get in. It's not full treaty, but you gather with some of the industrialized nations in the world, and you all make an agreement. We're not going to lower our taxes, our corporate taxes, below a certain amount so that we have less, essentially, corporations playing each other off on us. And the idea, apparently, the average corporate tax rate in the G7 is 24%. We are now below that. I don't know if that's just the rate. That's not necessarily the actual taxes paid, because that doesn't include things like loopholes and whatnot.
Which are prominent.
Which are very prominent.
Especially in the United States.
Indeed. But here is Yellen. She's going to go out and looking to convince other countries to impose a global minimum tax, reducing, like I said, the likelihood of companies relocating offshore. Offshore from us here and offshore from them. Basically, so that there's some type of like some measure of static quality, or at least you take the idea that we can't raise taxes on corporations and you know, worry about them leaving. And to be clear, the reason why you raise taxes on corporations, ultimately, and I don't want to get too deep into modern monetary theory here, but the U.S. government can pay for things because it prints its own money. We have in the U.S., something that is fairly unique around the world because we have control over our currency in a way that most countries do not. And we are still considered the safest bet of currencies in the world. We have these big debts and these big deficits. And what you're not seeing is us having to raise interest rates to convince people to lend us money. So there's no concern that we're going to default. The reason why you will raise taxes is twofold, essentially, or really threefold. One is if inflation gets too high, because demand overheats, you pull back some of the mechanism in which people express demand, and that is through their money. They can't use that money. There's less demand. And that's when you increase taxes, or you increase taxes because you're worried about wealth inequality. Because when corporations get these breaks on taxes, we know. You can look at the most recent data. You can look at the data from the jobs creation tax, tax moratorium that George Bush imposed on foreign repatriated taxes. They don't reinvest that money. They give that money to their shareholders, or they do it in stock buybacks, which is another way to give that money to their shareholders. They don't hire more workers. That's only a function of demand. They don't necessarily put more money into research and development. We have our corporate structures need to be tweaked, where you don't have stock buybacks, where you don't favor capital gains over wages, so that you're incentivizing CEOs and board of directors to manipulate their stock value, because they know when they get compensated in that, that's subject to less tax because it's a capital gains as opposed to a wage. But the bottom line is, the reason why you raise taxes on corporations in this way is because, not because necessarily that you need the money, because you can print the money. And one reason, maybe you do it to satiate certain political issues, and maybe it makes the reconciliation bill a little bit easier because you can offset certain things. But the main reason why you do it is because we have completely out of control wealth disparity in this country. And when you raise taxes on corporations, it is a bank shot, and you're raising taxes on wealthy people. Now, the next round of infrastructure, next tranche of infrastructure spending, which is going to be more focused on sort of human investment, is going to raise taxes, from what we've read, on people making more than $400,000 a year. And that's another good thing, because you don't want money to be so concentrated as it is in this country. And that is a form of essentially saying, like, okay, you're making a ton of money, we're going to raise these taxes so that we can lower wealth inequality, because wealth inequality destabilizes everything.
Here's my question to you. Why not do this in one major package if the second half of an infrastructure bill is likely to have to go through reconciliation in and of itself, and then you're going to use up all of your wishes?
I don't know if they're planning on rolling these two things together in one reconciliation sort of omnibus bill, or if they're going to try and push both these bills in reconciliation simultaneously. But there's a lot of people who are worried about just what you're implying, which is they'll take the first part and they'll pass that, and the second part they can hack up and they won't go down the road so much, because that's where you start to see spending on things like universal pre-K, and where you see it is like, you know, paid worker leave. Mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people who have the same suspicions you do. And it could be a strategy that the Biden administration thinks is easier. Can we swallow, you know, a smaller thing versus bigger? Or it could be just a way of like, well, some of this stuff is expendable. And we're, you know, when it comes to actually helping people directly, maybe that's more expendable than, you know, enhancing roads and bridges that are good for ultimately for corporations to
exploit. Electric vehicles all around the country.
I mean, look, that's not a bad thing.
I agree, but it's like, again, this just kind of managerial instinct or just less direct relief instinct.
It's good, but it's insufficient. It's necessary, but wildly insufficient. And we will see what the second half of that bill comes. But it is fascinating to watch as these Republicans really have no sort of response to any of this. Here's Pete Buttigieg, of all people, responding to Roy Blunt's criticism that you're throwing all sorts of other stuff like human infrastructure into this. Their perspective on what infrastructure should be, again, is like just even more purely about what would help commerce, as opposed to what would help people. Here is Buttigieg responding on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Just heard Senator Blunt right there said, if you really focused on core infrastructure, you might have a chance of passing this. And it is true that only about 5% of this bill goes for traditional roads and bridges. You've got 20% caregiving for the elderly, about 13% for investments in like the Green New Deal. So why not focus on that traditional core infrastructure?
Well, let's be clear. There's a lot more than roads and bridges that are part of infrastructure. I heard the governor of South Dakota recently saying, this is an infrastructure. It's got money for pipes. Well, we believe that pipes are infrastructure because you need water to live. And too many families now live with the threat of lead poisoning. That's absolutely infrastructure. You know, you talk about roads and bridges, but also airports and ports. We need to make sure that we have broadband. I know that traditionally the internet wasn't considered infrastructure because in the Eisenhower years, of course, it didn't exist. But infrastructure investment has to include looking to the future. Railroads seemed futuristic, and then we actually built them. Now they're considered traditional infrastructure. You could say the same about highways. And I've got a lot of respect for Senator Blunt, but I'm going to work to try to persuade him that electric vehicle charging infrastructure is absolutely a core part of how Americans are going to need to get around in the future, and not the distant, far-off future, but right now.
There's something that is so, I don't know, anachronistic. It's all kabuki. Like, the idea that they're arguing over the definition of infrastructure is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's almost, you know, it's like they, and you know, Buttigieg did a fine job. He did
his part. And
that's a
good message. That's a good message in order to, like, say, oh, you're right. You know, we want to build for the future. We want to be, it's a good way to get around that, I think.
It's just so, it just all seems so anachronistic to me. Like, Blunt is on, it's like almost like, it's like, I don't know. It's like watching
that black and blue dress or the white and gold dress. I see white and gold. No, you see black. And like, they're never going to agree on what it is. And so who cares?
But it's also, it also sort of feels like, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to malign tennis, but it looks like it's just like they're playing a sport that has gotten less and less centered in the national consciousness. And it's for an increasingly, and maybe this is, you know, I don't want to malign tennis, but whatever it is.
They're playing like Hi-Li or
badminton.
Whatever those old.
Yeah, yeah, let's say just badminton. And they're playing this and it's like.
Croquet.
Nobody is like, it doesn't matter. If it's called, like, I call it the infrastructure plus bill. Like, who cares? But it is, there is this sort of sense that you need to placate the elders in Washington, and nobody takes this seriously anyways. The people want their government to just provide them with stuff that's going to make their lives better. And if that includes healthcare for dad or mom or grandma or grandpa, then great. If it means that, like, we're drinking water and it's not going to screw up the neurological development of my children, that's great. If it means that, oh, I have public transportation, I can take this new trolley or this new train or this new bus or whatever it is, great. I have high-speed internet. I mean, what's amazing is that there's just sort of like this sort of tacit understanding between Blunt and Stephanopoulos and Buttigieg that, like, this is all sort of a bit of a production on some level.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it's one of those Washington insider things that we see all of the time where we're told that something is bipartisan because you have to meet in the middle between American Republicans and Democrats, when in reality, that's just the center of what power has decided is acceptable in Washington. So.
Here is, and this is a good sign, you know, that we sort of read the tea leaves of this sort of badminton game that they're playing on the Sunday morning talk shows. I mean, there was a time where, like, the entire country watched the Sunday morning talk shows and everybody assumed it was like there was some type of reality to it. But it, I don't know, it just seems bizarre to me. But this is a good sign. And that is Jennifer Granholm. She is the energy secretary in the Biden administration. And she is basically saying, you know, of course, like, we want this to be partisan, but let's play this clip.
Is the coronavirus relief package passed the House and Senate with zero Republican votes. Ultimately, looking at this bill, I'm wondering if that would be okay with you and President Biden again to have a bill pass with zero Republican votes.
Well, obviously, the preference is to have this done in a bipartisan way. 80% of America supports investing, over 80% investing in infrastructure. That's Democrats and Republicans and independents. So the president is very concertedly reaching out to Republicans to say, come to the table. If you don't like a component of it, tell us how you would do it. What do you want to see in this bill? But honestly, Jake, the vast majority of this bill includes things that Republicans are supporting, like roads and bridges spending, like broadband, like water, like manufacturing supply chains. These are all things that Republicans have actually introduced bills on. So come to the table. We want to make it bipartisan. You know, ultimately, if that doesn't happen, he is elected to do the job, to win the future for America, to invest in our people. And we hope that Republicans can join their constituents across the country
ultimately
in supporting this effort.
Ultimately, if you don't get Republican support, you're willing to pass this with using reconciliation rules, meaning only 50 Democratic votes in the Senate and Vice President Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. You're willing to do that?
Well, you know, as he has said, he was sent to the presidency to do a job for America. And if the vast majority of Americans, Democrats and Republicans across the country, support spending on our country and not allowing us to lose the race globally, then he's going to do that. However, his sincere preference, his open hand, is to Republicans to come to the table and say, if you don't like this, how would you pay for it? If you don't like this, what would you include? So much of this, though, includes priorities that Republicans have supported. So I hope that Democrats and Republicans can be on the final vote yes on this bill, on this package.
Talk about kabuki theater.
Honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's also, you know, like, and you know, I don't know why Jake Tapper can't say, hey, so you passed the first coronavirus bill, the first reconciliation bill was $1.9 trillion. And it was wildly popular, probably popular than legislation that's been passed that we can recall for maybe, I don't know, a decade, two decades, mm-hmm. maybe more. And you did it with absolutely no Republican support. Why wouldn't you do that again for something that 80% of the public?
Well, you know why he's not going to say that.
I do, but it's like, I just want people to understand, like, there is another way you ask that question that is actually even more of an obvious way to ask that question. You base it upon what recent history has been, which is, that worked out so well for you. Why wouldn't you do it that way again?
Well,
Granholm could say, like, well, we have to pretend like we're going to put our arms out to.
Yes. So that's the point. We had this discussion when they were still going back and forth on the American Rescue Package and discussing how Biden kept saying we want to bring Republicans to the table early on. And we all knew that wasn't going to happen. But we had a question. Is this Biden's actual inclination, or is he pretending as such in order to posture and make himself seem like he's the more reasonable one in the public's eye? And now I think the jury is in there. I don't think Granholm believes that the Republicans are going to come to the table on this, and the Biden administration doesn't feel that way. And so it does seem like a targeted to, I guess, older voters, in my view,
there's definitely
posture about reasonability, and I don't think that they're going to. The critique about them whittling this package down unnecessarily, I think should be prominent when discussing this. But I think they know that they're moving forward without any
Republican
votes.
Yes, and I definitely think there is an audience for what Granholm was doing. And you could see how she got a little bit more nervous when he said, can you answer that directly? Will you go through reconciliation?
Yeah.
She was out there to do sort of phase one of this, which is like, we're open to Republicans.
We're
come
reasonable.
In. Tell us what you want. I mean, I don't know why she couldn't add to that. Like, Republican voters also want their grandparents or their grandmother or their father or their mother to get more care at home, as opposed to having to go into a home, or more support for them to go into a home if they're disabled in some fashion. And what is interesting, though, is when do we get to the point where the Beltway corporate media is willing to sort of like change their premise from the 1990s to where we are 30 years later, where it's like, I mean, the default should be, why wouldn't you use reconciliation again? It worked out so well for you last time. There's no, like, you know, people coming from outer space to come in and go like, hey, whoa, whoa. We've noticed you've been using reconciliation quite a bit. We need you to pull back.
Not one Republican vote. Come on.
I mean, it's how the American public's reacting, and that's how they're reacting.
And the fact that they still haven't caught up after years and years of Trump and essentially the media being demonized by him, and they watched the Republican Party that they provided cover for years not go along with it as well. The fact that it's still taking this shows how systemic this, you know, religious obsession with bipartisanness and the fetishization of the Washington process goes even deeper than one that Biden held, because the media is still holding on to it.
I would agree. And what's interesting is that it seems that some Republicans, at least, are also sort of aware that, you know, the ground has shifted in some fashion. Axios reported on a House Republican memo, and Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine also wrote about this. It's sort of fascinating. The document is titled Cementing GOP as the Working Class Party. And they write it up sort of funny on the afternoon flight between
cementing. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Putting the seam on it, making it official.
This was a apparently Kevin McCarthy is the House Minority Leader. And Jim Banks, who leads the largest block of House conservatives, the Republican Study Committee, they were on flights to fundraisers, apparently with working class people. And Banks argues in the memo, he is a representative from Indiana, that despite the fact that there is a loud and embittered minority in the Republican Party that finds our new coalition distasteful, President Trump's gift didn't come with a receipt. In other words, you couldn't return it, he's saying. And on the messaging front, he recommends contrasting the GOP's immigration policies against Biden's border crisis. That is no different than anything we've seen. You know, this is Donald Trump riding down the escalator and saying, you know, I'm sure some of them are good people, but mostly Mexico's sending us rapists. Hammering the Chinese Communist Party's predatory trade practices.
Trade.
China.
So using the shadow of Trump's anti-NAFTA, anti-TPP 2016 campaign talk, and then just injecting xenophobia into it.
But Trump did that too. I mean, it's really just continuing it, right? I mean, he was always talking about this. Now, incidentally,
I mean, all the Republican Party was in favor of all of these multinational trade agreements and corporate proposals, but.
Right. It's unclear to me whether, you know, they're actually going to address that. Attacking Democrats for COVID lockdowns.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem to be terribly successful. But here it is. Pull up the memo. Here we go. Hammering wokeness and identity politics.
Yes.
And going after big tech. Now.
This is not a bad strategy, I got to say.
Well, wokeness, anti-wokeness. Wokeness was cooked up by college professors, then boosted by corporations, which is why now it's an official part of the Democrat Party platform. Nothing better encapsulates Democrats' elitism and classicism than their turn towards wokeness. Wokeness and identity politics aren't pro-Hispanic, pro-African-American, or pro-LG. Well, I guess they do LQBTQ? Yeah,
LQBTQ.
Interesting.
whatever. Just put a bunch of letters in there. It doesn't matter.
It's definitely not pro that.
Right. It's definitely not pro LQBTQ.
We could say that with definitiveness.
They're anti-American, anti-women, and most of all, anti-working class. Now, what wokeness is not defined in here. Because it's
whatever you want it to be.
It's right. It's just, you know,
I have
Democratness.
I have to say, though, you watch some of these shifts into how the wealthier class has trended more democratic in recent years. I don't have the data in front of me, but they've shown that, you know, the donor class has shifted in that area, as well as the Republican Party has left them in terms of respectability and then also just general kind of craziness. That's not a bad strategy. There is going to be a vacuum left as someone like Bernie Sanders, you know, isn't president, and you have Joe Biden and Kamala Harris leading the party. Some of these inclinations getting validated within the Democratic establishment and donor class. You know, if they're not more precise, this could actually help. This could be a good strategy by the Republicans if the Democrats are not precise.
Well, here's the best part about it is that they also say, I mean, because I think that is they're going to go after that. I mean, it is the culture war, just by a different name.
And the appearance of a populist economic war, which is,
well, they go on to say he suggests Republicans hold working class roundtables and create working families task force. And when it comes to fundraising, Banks argues that members should effectively embrace their pariah status in corporate America and campaign against corporate fundraising. Here it is, the action items. Hold the working class roundtables, create a working families task force. None of this is, there's no actual policies to support this. I mean, if you want to support working class families, you do universal pre-K, you do free childcare. If you want to, those two measures alone would be enormous. You provide for mandated parental leave, mandated sick leave. You raise the minimum wage. You support unions. They're all of these measures. They're going to get rid of that part of it. They're going to have...
They're not even going to talk about that part
of it. Well, they're going to message it for a little brief period of time.
I mean, except for the trade stuff, that's the only thing that they can hang their hat on, like, even, I guess, with legislation, because it's... Because you can tie Biden to those trade deals, I guess, but he wasn't even... Anyway, go on.
Well, now, of course, Republicans aren't going to survive without the corporate support. So Ed Kilgore has a very good point here. He says... Yeah. But Banks understands selective corporate bashing isn't enough to solidify working class support, because they're only going to do this, you know, based upon certain industries.
They're doing it in Texas and Georgia right now against these corporations. We are not with the corporate side who are backing out against, you know, due to their voter suppression laws.
Particularly since he and other conservatives, however populist, continue to oppose organized labor, progressive taxation, and other efforts to advance the material interests of the horny-handed sons and daughters of toil. So he urges Republicans to double down on the two economic strategies that do have resonance among at least white working class voters, nativism and protectionism. And that is, of course, you know, those that anti-immigrant sentiment and that xenophobia that you talked about, which is just an extension of where the Republican Party has been. It's just that this stuff is going to be more put for a front and center. And so that
is... It's more Tucker Carlson.
Exactly.
It's more Tucker Carlson than Sean Hannity. It is nativism, hatred of others. The country is... Your working people in this country are losing their grip because of this influx of immigrants, because of China, because of outsourced jobs. And it's just a more refined Trumpism that they're going to continue with. And unfortunately... You know, unless the Biden administration keeps up at their pace, that they're starting off with now at the start of the administration, there will be some legs for that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I would say in terms of Hannity, just give him a couple of weeks. And if he starts to see that it's effective, he'll bring out his football a little bit more and talk about how he did construction in college.
Tucker's the number one rated show on cable news. Hannity's right. Slipping.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more after this. So just wrapping up here, we, of course, are awaiting in the next, I guess, we don't really have a timeline for the Bessemer results. I thought we would hear by today, which is a week from when the voting ended. But apparently,
I think they said it's just going to, it could be weeks.
It's absurd.
There's a lot of, I think, legal hurdles and just all of this, like they need to certify it. I have no idea.
Well, we should say that Amazon, anyways, has apologized to Representative Mark Pocan about pretending that their workers don't have to pee in bottles.
Look at that. Scoop by Ken Klippenstein, who is changing the world, getting Amazon to change its tune. Look at, we had him on the show last week, and that was a good interview.
There you go.
Getting all these great scoops. Good
folks
journalism.
Can go back and watch that. And until you do, we will see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around... Stick around.
Please.
First off, I am instructed to... hold on. Wait one second.
Instructed?
Oh, yes.
By
Globalists? I have been instructed by my taskmasters to say hello to my mom and to Giovanni. Thanks, guys, for watching. And... it was good to see you guys.
Yes,
recently.
Great to meet you through the screen.
Well, you're not meeting them.
Well, you know, it's like I'm in their home, so
there you
sort
go.
Of.
All right, so we're going to head into the fun half. You can join us there by becoming a member. You go to jointhemajorityreport.com, and when you do, you support the free show. We give you the free show free of commercials, and then we give you the fun half. And all sorts of fun things. Like, I'm starting to get that, like, you know, I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'm feeling like April, May, June, July, we could be back in the studio, you know, by mid to late summer. And I'm getting excited about the prospect of that.
Oh, yeah.
That is, I'm over it.
Yeah.
I guess I've been over it for like that. It's the fifth time I've said that. Like every couple of months.
News to me that it just started.
There you go. Hey, that's not it. Where is the breaking news? I'm over it. But yeah, so we've got a lot of stuff that in the hopper, and we'll get back to being able to sort of produce the show in the way that we want to, instead of like doing it through Zoom and where that we've got audio problems. People email all the time. Like your audio dips out. We know.
Yeah.
We can't figure out why. And we just don't, you know, it's the Zoom thing and it is what it is. Meantime, Nomi is on vacation this week, but go back and check out some of the interviews she's had over the past couple of weeks have been amazing. The Nomi Key Show. You can find that on youtube.com/The Nomi Key Show. Also, don't forget Matt in the Matt Lekian Media Universe. What's happening in your neck of the woods, Matt?
Brian Brown, last week we talked about weed legalization, particularly in New York, and how Cuomo's sort of political sort of low point led to an actually decent legalization bill.
Yeah.
So check that out. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. Go subscribe at YouTube.
I was super psyched about that. I bet you, I mean, Matt, I imagine you were pretty excited.
You know, I take things very coolly, so I'm, but I am approving of it. So
I'm actually thinking of like doing like a, you know, like a outside, like grow. No, I'm not going to like, I'm going to grow one plant or something.
Right,
like that.
Right, right.
Yeah, you can grow up to like 3 or 6 plants.
I have a green thumb. That's why I do it. That's not so much.
I didn't know that about you.
A little bit.
We have to get cedar strains. We have to name the cedar strains.
Yeah. We could actually, we could sell it as, I don't know if we could sell it as merch. That would not be right. Yeah, well, we probably don't. but if folks have any ideas on that. Well, anyways, let's head to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you in the fun half.
What's up?